Morning. Thank you, Brandy. I want to start this with a couple of acknowledgments. Firstly, to all the folks at Mississippi State, well done. I know firsthand what an effort it takes to put on one of these things, and it's well done, and congratulations. Secondly, I want to thank Mark Inns for the kick in the pants to get started on this topic and to get... To get some thoughts in order that make this hopefully sensible. I want to thank my friend Joe Cassidy for appointing me to his task force that had no members. we're gonna do a little recruitment before this talk is over. I have some other co-authors that are people who share some of the responsibility for the good points of this talk. Scott Newman, Merlin Nielsen, Mutsabi, Mikhail Skolz, Scott Spadel. Those people all read the gibberish that I had and made some sense of it, and I thank them very much for their inputs. The mistakes are mine. The choice of this particular slide for the front is to say I'm an equal, with respect to breeds, I'm an equal opportunity employer. I don't have a breed bias that I think matters. I'm gonna start with an old slide. This slide, more or less, is attributable to Mike Tess at a BIF meeting in 2002. And I'm gonna start with one of my pet peeves. Who reads the literature? I mean, this is pointed at the scientists in the audience. There's a lot of stuff there that actually informs what it is we want to do today that maybe is not as well recognized as it should be. We'll start with a definition of efficiency that I took from the Webster's Dictionary. That definition is the ability to produce output without wasting inputs. And I'm going to suggest to you that it is about the balance between the inputs and the outputs. That's what's really important here. It's not about outputs holding inputs constant. It's not about inputs holding outputs constant. Now, if you don't understand, I'll be a little more blatant. It's not about some sort of a residual. It's about the balance between inputs and outputs. We gain efficiency by increasing outputs. We gain efficiency by reducing inputs. And what we really want to do is change both of those in concert with each other in a way that's most efficient. So it's about achieving that balance. And selection index is one way to do that. One of the reasons why efficiency is a very difficult topic is, generally speaking, the correlation between inputs and outputs is very large. And it's antagonistic to the improvement of both input and output simultaneously. That's why it's hard to improve efficiency. In fact, there's some data from Clay Center, Larry Cundiff and others that has been shared with this audience previously, where they looked at cattle from the 1970s and cattle from the 1990s or early 2000s and showed, in fact, that there'd been essentially no change in biological efficiency, despite the fact that there had been considerable change in the type or kind of cattle. So the equation here in the middle of the slide is due to Gordon Dickerson, who probably spent as much of a career studying the improvement of efficiency as anybody in the world. And it's a very convenient definition, I think, that incorporates both ideas about the breeding female and ideas about her offspring. And I want to put efficiency in the context of the production system with both of these factors considered, and not separating out something we might call cow efficiency and something we might call feed efficiency and something we might call some other kind of efficiency. I want us to think about efficiency in the context of a production system. And so, CJ, my comment about indexes is all the traits are in there. They just have different weights. But ideally, all the traits are in those indexes. That's my idealism. So cow efficiency, as we're going to talk about it today, I'm going to suggest to you, is an incomplete picture relative to the production system. That's not to say that it's not a valuable picture. I think it is. So what does the current suite of genetic evaluations say about efficiency? I think that's the fundamental question that we have. Does it actually serve our needs? And I think the previous two speakers just told us in a much nicer way than I would, the resounding answer to that is no. The current suite of genetic evaluations does not fully serve our needs relative to identifying those efficiencies. So there's more work that we need to do in terms of genetic evaluation. So I'm going to go back to this slide, and I'm going to point out that, and I should have done this previously, so in this slide, the definitions here, so RD is the cost of developing a replacement female. This is the cost that's independent of feed for that female. This is her feed for maintenance piece, the cost for her feed for production piece. The number of offspring that she is expected to produce on an annualized basis. So that's, for beef cattle, that's a fraction. For chickens, it might be a bigger number. And then we have some characteristics of the offspring. The days that the offspring requires to go from weaning to finishing. A production cost that's independent of feed, the feed for maintenance, the cost of feed for performance, and then some other costs that are associated with production that are not directly tied specifically to that individual. And in the product side, we've got the amount of product that female is expected to produce herself on an annualized basis, salvage weight, if you will. Annualized, so she doesn't get full credit for her body weight every year, and the value of that product, and then on the offspring side, the expected number of offspring, the product that the amount of product that's to be produced, and the value. And most of our current genetic evaluation systems have placed the greatest focus on feed produced for performance in terms of residual feed intake or something like that, some feed efficiency, and then the output traits in terms of the amount of product produced and its value. So the amount of product produced might be a carcass weight EPD or a yearling weight EPD or something like that, and the value might be a marbling score EPD or something of that sort. That's where we've put the most emphasis. But that's a small part of the picture. We've put some emphasis, but I would suggest to you lesser emphasis on the cost of developing replacements. So we've got something like a heifer pregnancy EPD that might weigh into that, and some breed associations produce such a critter, or a heifer calving rate EPD as an alternative. We've talked a little bit about the product, the amount of product that's produced in terms of mature cow weight EPD, those kinds of things. We've talked a little bit about the expected number of progeny to be produced in terms of something like a stayability EPD or a sustained cow fertility EPD, those kinds of things. But those have had less focus than the output side of things. Scott Spadel, and quite correctly so, pointed out that most of us have missed the opportunity that a days to finish EPD might lend to the system very directly, and I think that perhaps comes about most easily when we integrate commercial data with the typical seed stock performance data. And then there's some things that have had even less focus. Feed required for maintenance, both on the cow and on the progeny. In fact, we've tried pretty hard to weed out the maintenance part, despite the fact that Merlin Nielsen's mouse experiment at Nebraska tells us there's probably more genetic variation for maintenance than there is for performance. So maybe we ought to not be so quick to throw out the maintenance piece. The maintenance piece is also the biggest piece of the nutrient requirement of the cow. So when we take that out of our consideration of efficiency, we're actually taking out the biggest hunk of the feed. We've had less focus on the feed required for the cow's performance. There's a couple notable exceptions to that, but in general, less focus. And I don't want to suggest, I've done one of those marker experiments where you feed some rare marker to cows and collect feces and done all that, and I'm not going to suggest to anybody that you want to do that twice. If you've not done one, I invite you to the party. The second time around, you're a slow learner. I think that's one of the places really where we need to exploit the genomic technologies, Jared, and where the genomic technologies perhaps have a lot more to say about what we're going to do in the future than they do for some of the traits that are much easier to measure. So I'm going to focus today in the rest of my remarks on this part of the equation that has to do with the expenses associated with the cow. And I'm going to leave to somebody else to worry about the offspring and offspring performance for the most part. What I want to do is twofold. I want to review kind of my understanding of current genetic evaluation systems. And I'll be up front and say I do not fully understand what every breed does. There are differences, and I think there should be differences. I think breeds should do what they believe best for their breed, and those will not be the same in all cases. I'll join CJ in your plea for some disclosure. And then hopefully what I'm going to do is stimulate some progress toward systems of genetic evaluation that will lead us to more effective evaluation of those females. One of the things that I think is misunderstood is that every time you make a selection decision, however you do it, you employ an index. Doesn't matter whether you looked at the math or not. Every time you make a selection decision, you employ an index. And if you give some reasonably intelligent master's degree graduate student in animal breeding your data that you've used and which animals you chose and which animals you didn't, they can do the math. It's called index and retrospect. And they can actually tell you what weights you put on those traits that were there without you ever actually even knowing what they were. But you've employed an index. And so The knowing the index weights, well, did you know the index weights in your head? I don't think so. I think you took it on faith that those were the right weights. In my experience going to bull sales, I can't even keep it straight from one end of the offering to the other what weights it is I'm applying if I do this, if I try to do it mentally. And in fact, I know that I'm inconsistent in the application of those weights from one lot to the next if I mentally, visually evaluate those bulls. I know that I'm consistent if I do the math first, because then I can rank them. I can put them in order by the math in a way that I know I'm not consistent otherwise. So we're going to start by talking about current tools, what I perceive to be relative to cow efficiency, some of the current tools employed today. And we're going to talk first about the number of offspring marketed and what we have. Now, nobody's got an EPD for number of offspring marketed that I know of. But we have some things that are related. And number of offspring marketed over a cow's lifetime is really driven by two things. The probability that she produces a calf in a given year, and how many years she gets to do that. And that cow that didn't have very many years to do that has a lower efficiency than the one who did it for a lot of years. It's also helpful if she remembers to calve every year. We've got basically two different categories of analysis, if you will, stayability and then something that is derived from a survival analysis that the result presents itself as a risk ratio that's more or less the probability that that cow gets culled or the daughters of that sire get culled in a given year. Stayability fundamentally is a binary trait. There have been some efforts to reduce that need for it being strictly binary by assigning probabilities at younger ages. But fundamentally, it's a binary trait. It's a 0-1 trait. She either stayed to a particular age or she didn't. It's based on the assumption that you all cull open cows. I'm not sure how good that assumption is sometimes. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's not true sometimes. In fact, if I just went out and paid $75,000 for some seed stock female and she came open the second year I had her, I'm pretty sure I didn't sell her. And so I think some of that assumption is perhaps a little disconcerting. Stayability also makes what I'm going to call inefficient use of contemporary group information. Stayability basically puts females in a contemporary group once when they're fairly young and says, that's your contemporary group for life. When she gets to be 14, she's in a contemporary group of one if you're doing stayability at a 14. And then you have a problem with records that aren't yet complete. She's a 2012 born female and you're doing stayability to 5. So her record's not complete. Survival analysis does things a little differently in the evaluation that we've helped with the American Hereford Association. We use time-dependent contemporary groups. So the contemporary group for that female changes every year. And in fact, new cows join the contemporary group, and cows that leave the herd or leave the system leave the contemporary group. So it incorporates the opportunity to compare her to different sets of females over time. Most places that I know of, the weather changes from year to year. Some years are pretty good years and some years aren't so good. Right, Donald? Donald's had a few of those not so good years when he was praying for rain. And I think now he's praying the rain would go away. It's a little wet. The other thing that survival analysis allows us to do is to consider a female censored. So what happens to the female in the stability analysis when you sell her when she's three and she goes to somebody else's herd? She left your herd. She disappeared. She didn't really get the opportunity to get a one to get full credit for staying. And she becomes a contemporary group of one someplace else, so she doesn't get any counted, doesn't get any credit in the genetic evaluation. In the survival analysis, you'd call her censored. You'd give her credit for staying until three, for being there until three, and no demerit for the fact that she left at that point. So then if we switch and think about the replacement cost piece of the puzzle, we have an opportunity cost associated with the weaning weight of the calves that we don't get to sell. So if we have a higher replacement rate, there's calves we don't get to sell because we had to keep them around to make females out of them. That weaning weight's pretty well evaluated in present systems. I have no quibble with weaning weight being well evaluated. The post-weaning growth and feed intake pieces of that also play into that cost. And for the most part, I think they're pretty well evaluated. They're adequately evaluated. The feed intake piece may be less so than the growth piece. Because of some limitations on data collection, but in general, I think we'd say that evaluation is adequate. And then we have the pregnancy and calving rate sort of piece of the puzzle that I think is more problematic. And I think most of that problematic nature of those arises not from the evaluation itself, but from the data recording. And that's going to be a theme here. I don't care who you are, if you can't measure the phenotypes and report the data, the smartest analyst in the world can't make an EPD out of it. And in fact, not having that data creates problem in doing the EPDs, not only for the animals that you didn't report, but also for the ones you did. So the fact that you don't report the data from the culls creates a problem for your EPDs for the ones that you measured. Feed requirements. Last year, we had some folks talk at this meeting about the previous research that had been done on cow efficiency. And the outputs of that research was a set of prediction equations for feed intake, one of the outputs. Our nutritionist colleagues have spent a tremendous amount of effort producing NRC requirement books that talk about feed requirements for cattle. The good news here is when you validate those predictions against independent data, those prediction equations actually work pretty darn well. Brian Kirkpatrick at Wisconsin validating equations that were produced at South Dakota with data that was actually collected at the University of Wisconsin when those equations were validated, came up with R-squared values above 75%. So 75% of the variation in feed intake by cows in Wisconsin was predicted by equations developed in South Dakota. That tells me that the variables in those prediction equations are actually pretty darn good indicator traits for feed intake by the cow. In fact, today, that's probably a higher accuracy. Those indicator traits are probably higher accuracy than any genomic prediction we would have for the same traits. I don't think that situation lasts forever, but I think that's the current status. Feed intake, as anybody who's taken undergraduate nutrition knows, is also driven by characteristics of the feed. And particularly for cows, when we have those relatively challenging times of the year when the diet at grazing is more lignin than anything else, that feed intake is probably driven by the capacity of the cow herself. And in those good times of the year, when the grass is fairly is more valuable, let me put it that way, feed intake is probably driven more by some chemostatic mechanism that says, I've eaten enough, rather than by a mechanism that says, I'm full. I think the feed intake cow picture has a tremendous research opportunity in the area that I'll call metabolomics, where we apply some genomic technologies to metabolism so that we get the animal part of it driven in here. But I think we need to be cautious about how we interface the forage characteristics or for cow feed intake when we start trying to do the evaluation. So the first summary that I want to make is that some components of breeding, of the efficiency for breeding females, cow efficiency, are measured fairly late in life. That means at the time we're going to make that selection decision, the accuracy of that evaluation is going to be low. Same comment that was made previously about we don't know how she's going to be as a cow until she's a cow. We need to do some things to make that accuracy better at the time the selection decision is made. And I think that is improved by some early in life indicators. I don't know what those early in life indicators are necessarily. In all cases, and certainly among those is the opportunity that's imposed by genomics, by having genotypes. There's some components of that are exceedingly expensive to measure or painful to measure. Cow feed intake is one example of that. And that evaluation, again, is greatly facilitated by indicator traits in genomics. I'm going to make the plea that we not get excited about reporting the EPDs necessarily for every bloody indicator trait we could possibly measure, but rather, and I'm going to put that in the context also of genomics, that we not get excited about incorporating having separate reports of every bloody genomic breeding value we could possibly record or measure either, but rather that we integrate that information into an EPD for an economically relevant trait, and that we concentrate our reporting of EPDs on those economically relevant traits. I don't think that's anything that Bruce Golden wouldn't have told us at several meetings prior to this one. And finally, and perhaps most importantly for the producers in the audience and those who are generating the data for the EPDs, accurate reporting matters. Proper contemporary grouping matters. And one of the challenges that we've had in terms of putting genetic evaluations together has been the art, if you will, of putting cattle in contemporary groups based on the data. I'd actually make an argument that maybe one of the things that you could do as a producer that would help us greatly is help us form those contemporary groups based on what actually happened on the ranch, on the farm. These cattle were, in fact, managed together, treated alike. Instead of me guessing based on calving dates and management codes and those kinds of things, just bloody tell me. So let's talk a little bit about how we might implement these kinds of evaluations. Successful evaluation of efficiency, if it wasn't obvious already in that equation of Dickerson's, we need to capture of the variation in lots of traits, not just one or two. I'm not going to do a genetic evaluation for efficiency, and I'm not going to stand here and tell you you can. I'm going to tell you that the evaluation of efficiency is contingent upon the evaluation of component traits. Now, if that doesn't sound like I just made it a lot of work for everybody who records the data, I'm another plea. Let's not make that data capture so onerous that people say, to heck with it. I'm just not going to bother. I'll do it the old-fashioned way, by eye alone. We need to consider what data it is we ask breeders to turn in. And maybe there's nobody in this room, but I've talked to cattlemen who basically have said, it's too much bloody work today to turn in all the data. You know, I'd ask the Jack Wards of the world, you know, how many Hereford breeders are there? That what percentage of them are actually what the American Hereford Association calls gold TPR breeders, breeders that turn in all the data? It isn't 100%. It isn't even a real high percentage. But I think we need to consider what data it is we ask to be turned in, and we need to have a system which allows people the opportunity to achieve that standard where they report almost all or all of the data. The other plea here is that when we talk about whole herd reporting, that's not the females that are presently in inventory, and by default, if she was in inventory last year and she's not in inventory this year, she left. Let's be explicit about who leaves and why. Let's talk about the female that leaves and why she left. I think the disposal codes need to be reported. But I think they need to be fairly simple, and I think there needs to be some descriptor that tells us why that female left. I know breeders who basically go through their cow herd, and if she's 9 years old, she's gone. Don't care why, don't care what, she's nine, she's gone. She's culled for age. The big scientific community, have told you for years you ought to cull all the open cows. She's open, she's gone. Tell us she was gone. She's bred late. We favored early calving cows. Some people would cull them for bred late. Tell us. What about the female that was sold for breeding to another breeder or to a commercial enterprise? She was still a good cow when we sold her. She's a challenging one because she actually didn't get thrown away, culled. She just got transferred. And then there are some unsoundness things, whether it's udders, feet and legs, mouth, those kinds of things. I think we need some reporting of those, but I don't think it needs to be from a list of 45 scores. Because when you present that list of 45 criteria, yeah, you're being specific, but the tendency then is to find the number that designates other and put them all down as other. and other is not a helpful criterion, especially in that circumstance. So I think that if we're going to measure reproductive success or longevity, that's enhanced by those scoring systems. I think they need to be limited in number, and I think they need to be focused on those characteristics of the female that are actually economically relevant, as opposed to I didn't like her. I'm going to talk a little bit about survival analysis in a little more detail because I think it presents an opportunity to evaluate the performance of females in a way that's perhaps more powerful than is in general use today. The data is time to event data. It's time to, how old was she when she produced 4 calves? How old was she when she was culled? Those kinds of data. I think you could have, I mean, I was thinking about this last night and it occurred to me that we could actually do an evaluation for bull fertility using survival analysis. What was the age when his 10th calf was produced? What was the age of the production of his 10th calf? I've never tried that. I don't know if it works or not. But if you turned out a bull with 20 cows, hopefully he gets to 10 calves. But if you turned out a bull with 20 or so cows, you might actually say that there's variation in the age at which the 10 calves were produced by that sire. You might actually be able to evaluate bull fertility using the same technology. As I mentioned previously, contemporary groups in survival analysis can change over time. They can be dynamic rather than fixed. I think there's reasons why you want to do this. Not all years are alike. And the membership, the cows with which this particular female is compared from year to year change. Females leave that contemporary group because they were culled for one reason or another. Females join that contemporary group because we're trying to maintain a herd size. And then also we can incorporate censoring, whether we're waiting for the expression of the trait, or we're waiting for her to leave or die, or she left without expressing the trait. She left when she was 4 and the trait couldn't be expressed until she was 5. We put her in an embryo transfer program. We took her out of the normal production stream and put her in ET programs. She's a censored female in that context. We don't throw the data away that says she was successful for the first couple of years of her life. Rather, we just say she was successful for that long and then we did something different with her. So it gives us an opportunity to more accurately describe what's going on with that female. And I'm a fan of that. Survival analysis allows us to deal effectively with categorical data. Cow calves once a year. And for the most part, we've got 5 or 6 or 7 categories. She calved at 2, 3, 4, 5. It's categorical as opposed to continuous. And there's very well-established measurement or well-established mathematical ways to deal with that. There's some very new work that allows us to incorporate what the authors of the papers call frailty, which allows us to look at some variation, covariation that's not fully accounted for otherwise in the model, such as when we're doing a SIRE model evaluation of survival, incorporating the relationships among the females that sire was mated to. One of the things that I very much appreciate when I'm doing the simulations to develop indexes is that survival analysis yields straightforwardly an equilibrium age distribution. So I have a description of the cowherd by ages that helps me in that development of those indexes. Something that I've become interested in more recently has to do with geographic effects, and I'm going to attribute some of this interest to a nephew who's involved in the GIS area of research at the University of Minnesota. And I think this is right, although Jared and I are having a debate about this. I think the economic values change with the level of exposure. Now, you could argue the EPDs change, but I think it's the economic values that change. If we talk about heat tolerance means is economically more important to the producer in Texas than it is to the producer in Alberta or Montana. But if I run those cattle across a 50K chip and I get a set of genotypes, I could have identical genotypes in Texas and Montana. If the genotypes are identical, doesn't that mean the EPD is supposed to be identical? If you have the exact same alleles at the exact same loci, doesn't that mean... Jared, you're shaking your head. I know. Now, I would suggest the EPDs are identical, but the economic values are very different. Now, if we're going to do the EPD the old-fashioned way from phenotypes, and there's no variation in heat tolerance in Alberta because there's no heat, then the EPDs would turn out to be very different, yes. I think you have something like fescue tolerance that's the same, exact same thing. In Montana, we don't have any fescue, so there's no variation in fescue tolerance expressed in terms of phenotype. In Tennessee, where there's fescue, that might be a different story. One that bothers me a bit, but comes back from the days when I was breeding some Hereford cattle at Miles City, is calving ease. Calving ease in Texas, or in places where it's hot during gestation, it seems to be a different trait because the environment reduces calving difficulty, reduces birth weight, and therefore reduces calving difficulty relative to calving ease in a place where it's cold during gestation. And so I think the calving ease EPD, the economic value of the calving ease EPD, and maybe the calving ease EPD itself, changes based on geographic effects. And these are not well considered in our present systems of genetic evaluation, something that we need to work on. I'm getting close to the end. I promise you we will not miss break. Cow efficiency is part of that whole picture. It's only part. If we put together a cow efficiency EPD, we need to adjust the economic values that go into that in a way that accounts for the pieces of the puzzle that we're not considering. Now, this is going to have the liability that when we do that adjustment for those missing traits, those economic values, those weighting factors, are going to become a bit cryptic. And they may not be as sensible as the economic values if you saw them all straightforwardly. Cow efficiency EPD limits our opportunity to break some of the genetic antagonisms that are associated with some offspring traits. For instance, extreme leanness is likely to be antagonistically correlated with some of the components of cow efficiency. But if we don't have characteristics of the offspring carcass merit in that evaluation, we're not going to see that antagonism. We're not going to have an opportunity to work on it. In the past, we've focused on ratio measures. Ratio measures are both a blessing and a curse. I think they are well understood, and I think that communication has value. Ratio measures also cause us to be inconsistent in the weight, the emphasis we give to traits in the numerator versus traits in the denominator. And so I'd caution a little about the use of ratios. Also, past evaluations of cow efficiency in many, many cases have not actually considered reproduction. Yet the biggest single driver of cow efficiency is reproduction. If she doesn't have a calf at all, she's not very efficient. I think you have to consider reproduction in the evaluation of cow efficiency. And historically, that's been one of the weaknesses in our genetic evaluation systems. So here's my vision. Firstly, I want to say that we need to continue to do the evaluation of components. Don't believe for a minute that we're going to evaluate a trait called cow efficiency. It's not a trait. It's an index of components. We're going to combine those results, and I'm going to make a plea that we combine those results using selection index technology of one sort or another to predict genetic value for efficiency. We can do that in a variety of ways. I've listed a couple of them here. Gene Eisen showed us a long time ago that we could use restricted selection index. So we could strive to do something like increase output without changing input. Now, I argued to the front of the end of the talk, I didn't necessarily think that was a good idea. But we could do some sort of restricted selection index. And that might be sensible if you're a country that has a fixed resource for grazing. From a national perspective, I think it's sensible to say that's a fixed resource. Can't exceed it. And that might lead us to something like restricted selection index. Peter Amer in New Zealand has done a lot of work with microeconomic production theory to derive the economic weights as an alternative to simulation. I actually am a great fan of Peter's work. And I think there's some opportunities there that we may not fully have captured at this point. I think, as I just said, there's a limited opportunity in terms of an index that is for part of a production system to break the genetic evaluation or to break the genetic antagonisms rather with traits that are measured in other aspects of the production system. And I think that's a criticism that extends to some of our present circumstances as well. I'm going to tell you today the biggest impediment to a reasonable evaluation of cow efficiency is the lack of data to evaluate the components. And I think therein is the challenge for our breed associations and for the challenge for us going forward is to design a genetic evaluation system where we capture the information that we need without being wasteful of the resources of the producers that report the data. Efficiency really rests on two pillars, and I've separated these intentionally. The pillar of whole herd reporting I think that's important. I think we have to do whole herd reporting. And then there's a second pillar. Whole herd reporting coupled with complete reporting. It's not okay just to report a few data points. We need them all. And with that, I'm going to thank you. I'm going to invite you all to participate in this task force. Since we weren't assigned members, weren't told who the members were, I'm going to invite you all. The papers in the proceedings. My email address is up there. If you have any inclination at all, I'd invite you to take the paper that's in the proceedings and mark it up in red in whatever way you wish and send me those comments by the 15th of August. And my pledge to you is, if you do that, I will see that your comments are considered in the revision of that piece of work that's in the proceedings, so that we get as much input as we can. And in that way, you all have the opportunity to be member of the task force. And now it's your choice whether or not you wish to be. Thank you very much.